Well, good evening, everybody. I'm very pleased to introduce Professor David Harvey, who is, I'm sure everyone will know, Miliband Fellow at the LSE this term, and having a really good time.
Yeah.
In the eyes of many people, I think David Harvey is the world's leading geographer, but his work has spanned many other areas too, areas which overlap with the sorts of things that I, for one, are interested in. For most of his academic career, David has been concerned to explore social and environmental justice as it relates to urbanisation. He completed his PhD at Cambridge in 1961. After a period of teaching at the University of Bristol in 1969, he moved to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. His early work in the US culminated in his book Social Justice and the City, published in 1973. Still a classic text. Thereafter, his work focused on defining the relationship between economic change and processes of urbanization in the advanced capitalist countries. His return to Britain and Oxford University in 1987 entailed a broadening of emphasis to encompass questions of cultural change and environmental problems, particularly these relate to the urban and political focus of his earlier work. This phase of David's writing produced two famous books. The first, called The Condition of Postmodernity, I take it still your bestseller, probably. Mm. And a second one called Justice, Nature, and the Geography of Difference. He went back to Johns Hopkins in 1993, and since then his current interests build further upon his previous work. He plans to work, as I understand it, more extensively on questions of uneven development within a globalizing world. Professor Harvey has been the recipient of many awards. He holds honorary doctorates from the University of Buenos Aires, Argentina, and the University of Roskilde in Denmark, among other institutions. It was a great honor, I must say, and a personal pleasure for me to have him here at the LSE. His lecture tonight is called The Spaces of Utopia. David.
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me here right in the center of what I saw in the newspapers yesterday as the richest region in Europe. And so it's a privilege to be here in that center of wealth and power. Secondly, it's a privilege to be a Miliband Fellow. Miliband was somebody that I looked up to. Very considerably in my early years of interest in Marxism. There were not that many people to talk to or relate to. And way back then, and when I sort of realized the errors, at least some of my bourgeois ways, Ralph's writings and so on were actually rather important to me. I only actually met him twice, and it left an indelible impression. And there were two things that I remarked about that meeting. The first was, what impressed me was the incredible sense of very deep political commitment, a deep and abiding faith in the sorts of politics that he really did believe in. And that was something that was very special and stays with me. But it was coupled with something else, because I know many people who have political commitments of that sort, and they often turned out to be rather dour, boring, and sometimes very dogmatic people. But this was not true of Miliband. He was a very open person, had a love of life, tremendous kinds of capacity to argue and dispute, and an ability to realize he was wrong. And I think this was really remarkable, and for me it's something that I think I would hope in some little way I could emulate, and I would urge you to try and emulate too, which is to keep to your politics, stick to your politics, but at the same time be open and flexible in relationship to the world. And I was reminded of those meetings because the first time I met him, he came to Baltimore. And that, in a sense, is going to be the stage on which I want to set this story, because I went to Baltimore in 1969. I've lived there pretty much ever since and kept my roots there. And it's a city that, in many ways, I've grown to think of as my hometown. I love it in many ways. I love the people and have many concerns about it, have a deep and abiding affection for the place, and would like to be able to say very, very nice things about it. But unfortunately, I have to report to you that Baltimore is in a mess. And it is not the kind of mess that makes many cities kind of enchanting and interesting. It's in a horrible, ghastly, awful mess. And the thing that strikes me about it is that it's, in many respects, it seems a worse mess than it was in 1969 when I first knew it. But maybe it's the same old mess, but back in 1969 when I arrived, right in the wake of all of the sorts of uprisings and lootings and burnings after the assassination of Martin Luther King, the people at that time thought they could do something about it. There was some sort of notion of optimism that, well, we can go out there and change this thing. And now it's the same old mess, or maybe the worst mess, but nobody believes now they can actually do anything about it. And it's that sort of inability to think of alternatives and think of things to do about the sort of dreadful mess that the city is in that is going to preoccupy me when I talk today. I'm not going to bore you with all the details of the mess, but just let me give you a few little insights. We have 40,000 vacant or abandoned houses in the city of Baltimore and a housing stock of around 300,000. Okay? We have the lowest life expectancy of any jurisdiction in the United States, and it's equivalent to the life expectancy in places like El Salvador and Mali. We have, in relationship to those sorts of things, and I can sort of go on in that kind of fashion for a while, we have incredible sort of increase in respiratory diseases. The asthma rate has increased from 7 to 186 per 10,000 in just the last 10 years. Respiratory illnesses are sort of flourishing all over the place. We have the highest rate of syphilis transmission of any place studied by the WHO. Beautiful place, Baltimore, right? But alongside of that, with all of those indicators I've just given you, we have one of the best, most famous hospitals in the world, one of the most famous institutions of public health right in the city. We have some of the best schools in the nation, but they're all private, and therefore most of the children in the city can't go to them. And these contradictions start to sort of spiral out of hand after a while when you start to think about them. And it's those contradictions that I really want to dwell upon. Of course, it's not that nothing has changed in the city. In fact, a lot of things have changed in the city over the last 20 years or 30 years since I've known it. One of the big changes has been a sort of a mega project to revitalize downtown, the Inner Harbor. In order to do that, a lot of public subsidy went into building convention centers and things of this sort. Public subsidies were given to hotels, so Hyatt Regency, which is a very deserving welfare client, got a $35 million hotel for an investment of $500,000. We built football stadia, nearly $500 million on football stadium. We spent $5 million on just making a new stop on the light rail system for the football stadium. And this kind of investment in the city is creating a vast sink for public monies to disappear into. The National Football League in the United States is, again, a very deserving welfare client. It anticipates that it's going to get $3.2 billion worth of public subsidy during this decade. In addition to that, we then go on, the hotels that get built downtown, you need to give them $50 million in order to do this, and you need to do $50 million to do that. A condominium that goes bankrupt downtown gets a $2 million subsidy because we can't afford those kinds of things to go bankrupt. And when I say to the development director of the city, I say, well, can I get a subsidy if I go bankrupt? And the answer is, oh, no, it's only big ones. This is a process of absorption of public funds into the revitalization of a city which is not generating jobs, it's not generating anything very much except a vast boondoggle in terms of a public-private partnership in which the public takes all of the risks, the private takes all of the profits, and the net benefits to the population are really very close to zero. Those of us who are a bit dyspeptic about it call this feeding the downtown monster. Because the interesting thing about it is that every wave of public investment threatens to go belly up unless there's another round of public investment to make the first wave pay off. And so it goes. on and on and on, to the point where you really can't get off that particular trajectory. Now, there are many things about the city, and I'm not going to talk much more about it. There are many things about the city which are absolutely striking when it comes to the nature of the public policy which is set up. They finally recognize that the only kind of public policy that makes any sense is that which Engels outlined many, many years ago in the housing question, when he said, the bourgeoisie has only one solution to its problems. It moves them around. So the city has finally decided the best approach to the housing issue in the city is to demolish everything it can possibly demolish, in the hope that the poor people will leave the city and go live in the suburbs, because they won't have anywhere to live. And similarly, my own university has got very concerned about the conditions which exist around the hospital. So what do they want to do? They want to clear out the area around the university, and they want to sort of move everybody out of there. So this policy of moving it around is part of what is, as it were, the only piece of public policy that is left. And what we've seen actually over the past 30 years is a continuous process of moving around of the problem. This area is cleaned up, that area goes bad. This area develops, that area gets deindustrialized. The loss of jobs in the city has been catastrophic. The new jobs that have come into the city are, of course, low-paying jobs in which some people who are fully employed are living in homeless shelters. But the thing that really strikes me about it is the lack of any kind of imagination in thinking about this situation. And that lack of imagination is something that really scares me almost as much as the actual situation. And in thinking about that lack of imagination, I was very struck by a phrase that comes from Roberto Unger, the sort of critical legal scholar. When Roberto Unger asked the kind of question, how come, he said, we are such puppets of the institutional and imaginary worlds we inhabit? And I thought that's a very telling comment. How come we are such puppets? Even within universities, particularly in universities, we seem to be puppets of institutional and imaginary worlds, unable to think outside of the box, unable to contemplate something different. And I'm struck again and again in the Baltimore case with the constant reiteration of a certain theme, which you know too well on this side of the Atlantic, that there is no alternative. There is no alternative. Globalization won't let you, that won't let you, this won't let you. Nothing can allow you to do anything. You just have to sort of accept that your fate. It is a sort of fatalistic acceptance of a particular situation and a particular way of approaching it. Now, the curious thing about this is it's not as if there's any absence of any concern in the universities and elsewhere with the imaginary. In fact, we're surrounded with it all of the time. I mean, the humanities departments are full of talking about the imaginary, and everybody's talking about the imaginary. The physicists talk about the imaginary. And, you know, it's not as if we lack for imaginative reconstructions on television and all the rest of it. But here again, there's a very interesting phrase from Unger that strikes me as very pertinent to the current contemporary situation. He says, we seem to be torn between dreams that are unrealizable and prospects that hardly seem to matter. And in Baltimore, it seems like it's just the products of dreamworks or nothing. And that, as it were, is it. Now, Ernst Bloch, utopian sort of Marxist, once kind of commented, he said, how come possibility has had such a bad press? And why is it that there are so many interests ranged against the discussion of possibilities? And for Bloch, at least, one of the most important things was that a site of investigation of alternative possibilities lay in the utopian tradition. And for Bloch, a revitalization of the utopian tradition, a reaffirmation of the utopian tradition, was one step, as it were, on a path towards a different kind of regenerative politics. Now, I want to accept that proposition for a moment. And having accepted that proposition, then sort of say, look, there are some critical things to be said about the utopian tradition. If you go back and you read it, you'll find all kinds of fascinating features of it. Let me just give you one aspect, one instance, which is of critical importance to me, which is the way in which utopian schemas typically handle the question of space and time, geography and history. The classical utopias all had in common the following feature, that what you did was you used space and the qualities of space in order to control the social process, in order, in fact, to prevent history from occurring, to prevent the social process from unfolding. They were anti-dialectical. They were anti-historical. And they were searching for some kind of stability of a social scene. In effect, what they did was they used space to control time. They used space to quieten history. Now, that way of dealing with it leads into a category which I call utopias of spatial form. And most of the classical utopias were precisely that. They used the spatial form for that purpose. And as utopias of spatial form, however, they also had a function, because what in effect people were trying to do was to instantiate some social order by construction of a spatial configuration. And depending upon what social order you had in mind, you ended up with a different spatial configuration. So actually, if you look at the whole history of all of the utopian schemas, what you'll see is them playing with spatialities, playing with those spatialities to achieve completely different social purposes. So there are feminist utopias, there are anarchist utopias, there are sort of socialist utopias, there are all kinds of utopias which have different notions of what is the kind of sociality which needs to be constructed and preserved, and that is the kind of spatiality that is made. Now, Louis Marin has a very interesting way of looking at this. He calls the spatiality, a matter of utopics as spatial play. And I like that idea. It says you play with space, and you play with it different ways to achieve different social purposes. And it is a playful thing that you engage in. And it is an exciting thing that you engage in when you do that. And Marin used that notion of spatial play, I think, to open up the way in which utopias of this sort are indeed a center of imaginary thought about alternatives. But there is another problem with them. That is that they're spatially closed. Most of them are on islands or mountains or something of that sort. And there is, in fact, a closure, an authority structure which builds around them, which actually so controls the social process as to make it oppressive to anything other than the basic forms of sociality that are meant to be validated. So that utopias of spatial play, on the one hand, have this incredible imaginative capacity. On the other hand, they have this authoritarianism built into them. They have closure built into them. And once you've closed it, you've stopped it, you've controlled history. That's what you've done. And it is that dialogue between spatial play and authoritarian closure that seems to me essential to their understanding their history. And of course, if you're somebody like Foucault, you emphasize the closure and the authoritarianism. If you're somebody like Marin, you emphasize the spatial play. But it is the dialogue between the two which seems to me to be significant. Now, there is something problematic then about the way in which time and process gets handled in those utopias. And I think this problematization comes out when you look at the way in which utopias of spatial form got realized on the ground, how they got built, when they did get built. The Le Corbusier schemes, the Ebenezer Howard schemes, you know, those sorts of things, or even the utopias such as New Lanark and Icaria, so on, how they got built. And if you look very carefully at this history, and I've been looking at it much more closely than I'm able to discuss here. But if you look at this history, you find central to this history is the following paradox. That in order to build a utopia on the ground, materialize it, you have to mobilize a social process. So in a sense, what you do is you have to, in mobilizing that social process, you actually destroy the capacity of the utopia of spatial form to control what it is it's supposed to control. In other words, if you look for a utopianism of spatial form to control capital accumulation and the development of state power, and then you have to mobilize accumulation of capital and state power to build your new town or whatever, then you've mobilized the very force you're trying to control. So when you look at the materialization, you find that there is this very serious kind of problem. And this came out in a wonderful category that Marin set up, which is the category of what he calls degenerate utopias. And the degenerate utopia he wrote about, in a wonderful chapter, which I suggest you go read, was Disneyland. He said, you know, Disneyland is a degenerate utopia. But the interesting thing about the Disneyland he was describing is that Disneyland was built. Now, of course, Disneyland is an island. It is totally socially controlled. It is sort of a fantasy space within which certain things can occur and others cannot. It is, as it were, a model of degeneracy that occurs when those utopias get built in a certain kind of cultural, political, economic configuration. Now, it so happens that James Rouse, who was one of the big developers in the United States and did a lot of his work in Baltimore, James Rouse recognized that Disney was onto something. So James Rouse constructed the shopping mall as a version, as a kind of utopian space, as it were, within which you could pursue the world of I shop, therefore I am. So that what Rouse did and what then followed was, in a sense, the sort of degenerate utopias all over the place. In fact, the United States is full of them. Robert Fishman recently has talked about bourgeois utopias and said the whole suburbs have to be looked at in that kind of light. And I think that is basically correct. So when you critique both the actual structure of utopian arguments and the way in which they get materialized on the ground, you kind of would say, look, I don't have much confidence in this whole thing. And that was the situation I arrived at about 3 or 4 years ago. And then in the Justice, Nature, and Geography of Difference book, I made a casual suggestion, kind of said, well, you know, maybe what we should be thinking about is utopias of process rather than utopias of spatial form. And I thought that was a neat idea. But I've quickly found there are two particular problems with it. The first I found when I was invited up to Philadelphia to the School of Landscape Design, where a bunch of students got very excited about this particular line in that book and were very impressed by it and decided they were going to follow it and therefore they were going to push their design processes in certain ways. And they had all these wonderful designs, and there I was adjudicating them, and they had these wonderful kinds of stuff. And then I get to the end and I say, well, what are you actually going to do? And they said, oh, well, we don't have to decide that. It's still in process. So they could get their degrees without finishing their project. Now, if you offer that to any PhD student, they'll love you. So they thought it was a great idea. But notice what that said. That said, there's a problem with the notion of a utopianism of process, which is about what... It's precisely about closure. When the dialectic becomes either or, when you have to decide to do something or not to do something, you've got to close around something. So you cannot have processes that are perpetually open. And yet the notion of a utopianism of process is itself very interesting, because it really it is no place whatsoever. You don't even consider the notion of spatiality and the formal structures of space. This also led me to realize that, of course, there have been plenty of utopianism. There's plenty of utopianism of process around. I just hadn't sort of got used to calling it that. And generally speaking, we don't call it that, with a few exceptions, Karl Polanyi being one. There is a utopianism of process at work, of course, in Hegel. There is one in Marx. That is, in Marx, class struggle leads us at some point or other to the promised land. We don't actually define what that land looks like. We don't say what its design is. But we're given the process whereby we can get there. So it's like, you know, Thomas More gives you the spatial form but not the process. Marx gives you the process but not the spatial form. But in order to develop his particular notion of social process, Marx had to deconstruct that other form of utopianism, the social process, which was given to us by Adam Smith, which is the utopianism of the market. Let the free market do its work, allow the free market to do its work, and we will end up in this great paradise. That's what Adam Smith told us, and that's what we have periodically been told in the long history of capitalism when people decide that planning and social control and state regulation is a bad thing. So we zoom off back into this sort of rhetoric of Smith and says, let the market do it. That's what Margaret Thatcher would say. That's what Reagan said. You know, let the market do it. Everything will be fine. But what Marx does in Capital is something very interesting. What he does is to take that notion of competitive markets in Smith and say, okay, I'm going to actually accept the Smithian schema. And I'm going to show you what happens. And what he does step by step through Volume 1 of Capital is to bring you to a point where you see that the consequence of following that particular utopian schema is that the rich grow richer, the poor grow poorer, that you're going to destroy the sources of all wealth, the laborer and the soil, and that the income inequalities and the sort of structures of exploitation are going to harden and become more and more devastating for human populations. So Marx, in a sense, says, put that utopianism of process in motion, and that is what you're going to get. Well, we've gone close to putting that into motion the last 20 years, and what have we got? We have vastly increased inequalities of wealth. We've arrived at a position in cities like Baltimore, the kinds of things I've described. We have, according to the World Bank, 2.5 billion wage workers in the world right now, and a billion of them are trying to live on less than a dollar a day. In the United States, we have this incredible sort of lopsidedness of wealth, in which somebody just calculated that the net worth of Bill Gates is equivalent to the 107 million poorest people in the country. Extraordinary sorts of inequalities. With inequalities between rich regions and poor regions accelerating. And all of those can simply be explained by the equality of the market, because the one thing that Adam Smith never kind of quite understood is the old adage that there's nothing more unequal than the equal treatment of unequals. And there is an egalitarianism about the market, but drip by drip, as the market works on an unequal surface, so it creates these mountainous differentiations of inequalities. So that's, if you like, the problem that exists. And that problem becomes particularly significant when you start to look at how the process actually works on the ground. You see, the utopianism of process, as laid out by Adam Smith, never actually bothered to specify what happens on the ground as you build cities and build regional development patterns and the like, because you never had to actually deal with spatiality in the Adam Smith system. But there's a particular moment in The Wealth of Nations where he has to deal with it. He has to recognize that in the East and West Indies, the benefits of the market have not worked out. That, in fact, the effects have been devastating for the populations in the East and West Indies. And he kind of says, well, it's because there's such an initial inequality that I guess it's hard to overcome it. But in the long run, of course, if we can only get the market going, everything will be all right, which is a story we've been hearing now for the last 200 years. But if you look very closely, what you see, if you use concepts, even sort of concepts like Gunnar Myrdal's notion of circular and cumulative causation, the ways in which rich regions grow richer and poor regions grow poorer, rich people grow richer and poor people grow poorer, just to give you an example how the rich people grow richer. 1% of the United States population owns 50% of the stock values in the United States. How rich do you think they've become over the last 15, 20 years, given what's happened in the stock market? 60% of people in the United States hold nothing in the stock market, even in their pension funds. Look what that does to the redistribution of wealth. So there are then these problems with utopias of spatial form. In exactly the same way, there are utopias of the social process. Both of them have their downsides. So what do we do in the face of the critique of those two forms of utopianism? Well, there is, of course, a very simple answer to be explored, and I'm very surprised in some ways it has not been explored, which is to say, the reasons why we separate space and time in the ways we do are not very cogent. Why can we not develop a utopianism that is spatial and temporal, which is both geographical and historical? Why is it that we've been stuck, as it were, in that sort of imaginary universe where we either had to do one thing or we did the other? And why, therefore, are we not exploring what I would call a dialectical utopianism, which is about transformative activities in both space and time? And what would a dialectical utopianism look like? And how would it work? Well, it turns out that a dialectical utopianism is not exactly an empty box in terms of historical thinking and historical work. You can find elements of it in the work of Geddes and Mumford and people of that sort as they tried to think more in a sort of more evolutionary way about the development of regional configurations and cities and the like. So there are elements of the thinking scattered around, not brought together. But there are some very interesting places where you will find it very strongly developed. And some of those occur in utopian novels, which are actually quite exciting explorations of spatio-temporal transformations, sometimes with sort of a violent break, but in other cases with, as it were, smoother transitions. For example, if you read a novelist like Kim Stanley Robinson, a trilogy on Settlement of Mars, what you'll find is that he's actually talking about a spatio-temporal dynamic, reconstructions of social orders through spatio-temporal transformations. But the difficulty with that particular genre of exploration of utopianism is it loses its political clout, it loses its political edge. That, in fact, we find ourselves back in that category that Unger mentioned when he says that we're back where dreams are unrealizable, in a world where prospects hardly seem to matter. So one of the tasks I started to think about was how to write a more dynamic, dialectical utopianism. How to do it. And I haven't got a complete solution. But I have some talking points that seem to me to be significant in relationship to it. Several talking points. But the one I want to dwell on right now is what I will actually... is actually inspired in some ways by something that comes out of the Communist Manifesto. Marx and Engels, when they're talking about socialist organization and labor organization, suggested that there was a certain trajectory of that organization. It starts, they said, with the individual. Individuals then working in factories begin to consider their common interest, and then within a locality start to be concerned with the way in which the locality is constructed. Then through communication with other localities, they move to another scale at which politics can be constructed, eventually arriving at the construction of class institutions at the level of the nation state. And then the next step, of course, is the final call of the manifesto, which is, workers of the world unite. So in a sense, what you see there is a relationship between the individual and the global. And they're seeing it and as a series of transitions and transitional steps. Now, I want to take that model and problematize it and work with it and make the following kind of political statement. Political change is going to depend upon action in all of those particular arenas. Let's call them theaters of insurgent activity. And the first point is to say that personal is political. Well, we all understand what that means. It's the kind of thing you find, you know, when my wife says to me, you're always going around talking about social change, but you always forget to take out the garbage, you know. And we all know the sorts of problems that arise exactly out of that. And then there are political movements. You find amongst ecologists and some feminists and so on that say the personal is political, is where it's at, and that is the beginning and end of what politics is about. It is a necessary and sufficient element. I think the answer to that is no, it's not. But it is always there, and it is a fundamental element of any kind of transformation. Through changing the world, we change ourselves. That's the basic Marxist proposition. And if we wish to change ourselves, we have to change the world. And it is that level of the personal is political that is fundamental. But the person is also a social construct. That is, we don't exist in a vacuum. We assume our personalities in particular places and particular ways. We're not, as it were, little atoms floating around. We are part, embedded in all kinds of social processes that are constructing us. And this creates all kinds of problems because it says, I don't freely decide what I'm going to do. And of course, Marx problematized that by kind of saying consciousness doesn't arise out of, you know, just anywhere. It arises out of material circumstances. Actually, Adam Smith said the same thing. He says, our ordinary employments corrupt the courage of our mind. Very good line. And the question then arises, well, if we have all of these ordinary employments, how can we actually get out of just thinking what we are allowed to think in the course of those ordinary employments? How can we actually get past the inevitable corruption of the courage of our mind that comes from our ordinary employments? So that the personal is political has to be set against those situations in which our ordinary employments are doing these things to us. Now, that means there is a battle at that level between the personal is political and how our ordinary employments are corrupting the courage of our mind. And we can, of course, change our employments. We can put ourselves at risk in different situations, different ways. And that is indeed part of what most personal learning processes are about. But then there is, beyond that, the question of the collectivity, the political collectivity. In what ways can individuals come together? In the way that Marx and Engels started to talk about in the locality, in the factory. In what ways can people come together to kind of construct some sort of commonality of political beliefs and even institutions? And how can that happen? And what happens when those institutions and those that coming together, as it were, everything stops there with what we now know as communitarianism? So there is, as it were, floating around right now, a strong kind of push towards communitarian solutions. The community is the solution. For some, it's the personal is political. For others, it's the community. Get ourselves a community and then everything's okay. Well, it's very important to construct communities of political interest. But when communities become communities for themselves, they tend to get repressive, exclusionary, keep the others out, and you get the kinds of segregations which you will now find occurring in the gated communities of the United States as the rich lock themselves off behind these huge barriers to keep that awful world out. So the moment of establishing communitarian interest is very important, but if you stop there, then you've got problems. It almost invariably reverts into sort of almost neo-fascist neighborhood organization, which you can find plenty of in many cities. Which then takes me to another level, which is the idea, which I've explored in other places, of militant particularism. The way in which particular groups of people in particular places and particular times have established notions which they then project into the world as universal principles. We should all be like this. You know, the French in Paris describe, you know, set out and kind of talked about the universal rights of man. Nobody in China knew particularly much about it at the time, but that declaration has nevertheless had significance in these times for what is happening in China. So that these kinds of ways of thinking, in which you start to project out from particular experiences into an alternative world, in general, becomes a very important moment. But in order to make that moment work, you need something else. And I think the thing I'm particularly interested in right now is the whole kind of problem of translation. How do we translate across a terrain of uneven geographical development, across a terrain of different cultural histories? How do we translate in such a way as to be able to establish the commonalities that might exist? Now, everybody knows that there's a certain sense in which full translation is always impossible. And we can accept that. On the other hand, we also know that there's some very good translations around. And furthermore, we also know, just to make it more of a problem, that the power of the translator is often a very significant power. How, in the words of somebody like Said, you know, or the Oriental world got translated into Western language was a very important reflection of the power and interest of the translator. But we now know that. And we are therefore caught up in the problem of many militant particularisms around the world desperately searching for modes of translation. Because if you asked where is the opposition to neoliberalism in the world right now, where is the opposition to the free market and capital accumulation, you'd find it all over the damn place. Everywhere. The difficulty is that it has not been pulled together. That is, in the Engels, Marx kind of version of the world, it's got so far, but it hasn't got beyond that to a point where it can articulate oppositional ideas either at the level of the nation state or, for that level, for that point, at a more universal scale. So that translation then is also a very important moment in this process. And translation is a two-way affair. It says, I take your thought, bring it into my language, you take my thought and take it into yours, and then we see what we make of it. So translation across becomes absolutely crucial to knitting together these different militant particularisms, these different forces in opposition, and starting to say what kind of commonality exists within all of those multiple differences which we've known a great deal about and heard a great deal about over the last 15, 20 years. Then there are mediating institutions. Mediating institutions have an ability to take universal principles and translate them into particular circumstances. And there are a wide range of mediating institutions, the nation-state being the most obvious one. And those mediating institutions are absolutely vital to be transformed, overthrown, reconstructed, or what you will. So that the level of mediating institutions becomes critical. But again, you cannot stop there. Because there is always, at the end of the day, the question, workers of the world unite, well, what do we unite around? How do we unite? What are the universal principles that we might adhere to, construct? Now, this is a very difficult kind of thing. Very difficult kind of thing. But we cannot actually abandon it simply because of its difficulty. And the reason I think it's important not to abandon it is because there is a certain power behind making certain universalistic claims and using those universalistic claims as a basis for political mobilization, political action. Let me give you just a couple of claims, which I think are very interesting, and see if you can guess where they're from. Everyone, as a member of society, has the right to social security and is entitled to realization through national effort and international cooperation and in accordance with the organization of resources of each state of the economic, social, and cultural rights indispensable for his dignity and the free development of his personality. Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. Everyone without discrimination has the right to equal pay for equal work. Everyone who works has the right for just and favorable remuneration, ensuring himself and his family an existence worthy of human dignity and supplemented, if necessary, by other means of social protection. Everyone has the right to form and to join trade unions for the protection of his interests. Everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including reasonable limitation of working hours and periodic holidays with pay. Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. You know where that's from? 1948 Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations. And it's not hard to take all of that and say neoliberalism is in violation of human rights. The whole social policy of Clinton is in violation of human rights. The whole reform of the drastic reform of the welfare system is in violation of human rights. You know. Now you can kind of say this is sort of abstract rhetoric and so on, but it's there and it's been signed. And nobody has taken a goddamn bit of notice of it for the last 50 years. Now, I'm not saying these rights as specified are perfect. They're to be fought over, argued about, discussed, if you like. And they can be transformed. But what is so interesting is that there they've lain for 50 years and nobody has ever used them. And when you use them, there's a certain power. We've been trying to make my own university be what we call a living wage institution in the United States. That is, nobody in the institution should be paid less than what we consider a living wage. When we took these kinds of comments about human rights and said, look, this is the 50th anniversary of the signing of the human rights, and you, president of the university, are in violation of all of these human rights, the university got very upset. I mean, if I was just a Marxist and went in and did my usual thing, they wouldn't take a bit of notice, you know, but they took a lot of notice of this one. So there's a certain power that comes from that. Now, you can look at this and say, these rights are defective in all sorts of ways. You can see the gender bias, you can see the bias towards family, you can see all those things. Yeah, they're defective in all kinds of ways, but at the same time, they also give you, as it were, some universal ideas which are empowering in certain ways. Now, they are not the answer. And that's why I want to come back to this notion of these different theaters in which action can occur. Because universal rights don't exist out there. They are born by individuals. We are bearers of them ourselves. And insofar as we're bearers of them ourselves, the personal is political, is part and parcel of this whole kind of question of the universality side of things. So what I want to suggest then is that by thinking across the personal is political and the way in which the person gets socially constructed, the way in which the community, militant particularism, translations, and so on, we can think of a whole series of theaters of action which need to be kept in relationship with each other. I think the problem with the way Marx and Engels set it up is it kind of seems like you're ascending a set of steps and you're arriving at the top and there you are. And once you're at the summit, that's all there is to it. Whereas it seems to me better to think of this as a long frontier in which the universal is always in dialogue with the personal and the particular. The mediating institutions are always being constructed through these other particular political processes. And it seems to me learning the art of thinking across those different possible terrains and learning to think about the relationships between possibilities in those different theaters of insurgent political activity, if we could start to think about a more dialectical form of utopianism, one which would be, as it were, at the heart of a transformative political project. It's difficult. And it's, I think, difficult for all the reasons which have been embedded in what I've been saying. When Unger asked that devastating question to me personally, how come you are such a puppet of the institutional and imaginary world you inhabit? It was hard to think of ways to get out of it. It was hard to think of how to change the university so that it was not simply engaging in puppeteering activities instead of making people think and work through alternatives. And indeed, our ordinary employments corrupt the courage of our minds. We're so damn busy, we don't have time to think about all these things. We're so caught up in what we have to do within our specific functions that we don't have time to work through these things. That's true. But then overcoming that is really what it means to have the courage of your mind. And in a sense, that line from Adam Smith that talks about the way in which the courage of our minds gets corrupted is also something which bears reflecting upon. Because until many of us start to have the courage of our minds in the way that, for example, Miliband had, then it seems to me we're not going to get an alternative politics. There is not going to be a real alternative. And I think that that is a devastating comment on the way the world is. In universities and all the rest of it, we're fond of talking about how everything is, you know, imagined and made. Well, it can be reimagined. It can be remade. And we can reimagine it. We can remake it. But we can't do it just simply by the personal, you know, we have to do it across those different theaters. And there's going to be a lot of contest in the process. But that contest is, it seems to me, what having the courage of your mind is all about. And as I mentioned, Miliband had the courage of his mind. And so I'm delighted, I think, to try to reaffirm what I think he would want to have reaffirmed, which is there are real alternative possibilities, and that we can really think them through in an imaginative and constructive way. Thank you very much.